working on set, you're all one. It's kind of like an unwritten language that you just, you can communicate with very little, which is always a better way to go.
This is the Action Filmmaking Decoded Podcast. A podcast dedicated to raw action analysis.
Ooh, my gosh. For fans of action cinema out there, how badass would that be?
Each week, we bring you a new action filmmaker to break down your favorite scenes.
360 off person, round kick the guy from a 360 spin.
Now, introducing your hosts, Darren Tun and Mike Messina.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Action Filmmaking Podcast, a podcast dedicated to breaking down action films of all types. My name is Darren Tun, and with me is my amazing co-host, Mike Messina. Today, we have a very special guest, Keir Beck. He has an extensive filmography, including award-winning stunt coordination for Mad Max Fury Road, Hacksaw Ridge, and his other works include Casino Royale, The Matrix series, and now Fast 9, Spiderhead, and The Matrix 4. Keir, how have you been holding up with everything that's been going on?
But you know what? It's been a strange time to be working around the world with the COVID pandemic. Yeah. But I've got to say, amongst all the craziness, I've had a really productive and busy year. So I'm very grateful for that.
That's awesome.
I know a lot of people out there aren't having such a good year, but you know, I'm grateful that there's still work out there for us, which is good.
Mm-hmm. Mostly done virtually, but yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's definitely a new virtual world with the way we communicate.
I know it's like 8:30 there, 8:30 a.m.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's morning. Yeah, yeah, early morning.
Are you normally a morning person?
You know what? I usually am, Darren, but since I've been in this quarantine thing, my time clock is just really, really strange. And I think also the first week I was in here, I exercised myself to death. And I'm so sore that I think that's messed me up a little bit as well. I can hardly walk.
Oh, wow. You have a little bit of a home gym over there?
I do, man. I'm set up good.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah, I think that's most of us right now with quarantine going on.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Got to be resourceful.
Yeah. And you also mentioned that you were working on Spiderhead. So how's that going? I mean, I know you can't probably reveal too much, but just like, how's the production going in general?
Yeah, great. They've started their pre-production. So basically I've been running my pre-production from the hotel room. So, you know, that just usually involves phone calls and meetings and, you know, gathering information about how we're going to tackle the sequences that we've got.
That's awesome. Yeah. So we just want to jump into probably just like some general questions before we dive into like movie breakdowns. Mike, I know.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I've been dying to know a little bit about your past as a tree surgeon. It was super interesting to me. And I feel like, you know, someone, you said in previous interviews that you had the dream of going into film and stunts since you were younger, before you went to school for horticulture in the States. So I'm wondering, how formed was that dream of yours to go into film when you were younger? And at what point did you make the decision to really actually seriously go for stunts and the film world?
Great question. You know, I knew when I was at school growing up that I wanted to be in the film industry. I was always attracted to stunt work. And I used to watch all those Dukes of Hazzards and all those shows on TV as a kid and just be fascinated with car crashes and the way they did action in films. I mean, I had no idea how they did it back then. And at the time I had no idea, but I was just always fascinated with the you know, it just looked like a really cool lifestyle to be involved with. So I left school and then, you know, my dad was like, oh, you should get a qualification and do something with your life. So I'm like, okay. So I studied horticulture, which then led on to becoming an arborist I studied in just out of Philadelphia in Pennsylvania for back in 1990, funnily enough, at Longwood Gardens, which was a fantastic experience. So I learned to become an arborist there. Then all through the 90s, basically, I was just hooked on climbing trees and climbing rocks and mountains. So I kind of didn't get sidetracked, but I went on a journey of kind of just you know, climbing things and being physical and working with trees. And then that led on to, well, what happened was I bumped into an old school friend and she just finished working on the Matrix film, the first one. And she's like, oh, didn't you want to do stunts when you were at school? I'm like, yeah, I did. And then from that evening, I was like, that's right, I should go off and do that. So I just, basically, I was living in Western Australia. I packed up my bags with my wife and then we moved over to Queensland. And a month later, I was working on the film Pitch Black with Vin Diesel.
Oh, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
So it just happened really quickly.
Yeah, that's interesting. I know that you've worked on the Matrix sequels. I didn't know that your friend came off of the Matrix when you were sort of talking about whether or not you'd go into stunts. Did you run into that friend at any other point in further Matrix productions or anything like that?
Not after we'd bumped into each other. That was kind of like a one-off encounter where it was just an in passing afternoon. And yeah, it was just a kind of very coincidental, but it was like she was sent as the messenger. go and do stunts before you get too old and crusty.
Serendipity.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely.
Oh, is that what she said? Okay.
So, it's very, very cool.
Yeah. And speaking of friends, actually, speaking of friends, I know that you have sort of a team of people that you've been working with for a while where you'll go into different stunts and productions and sets to work together. Can you talk a little bit about your team and what makes you all work together so well?
You know, I've always loved being a part of a team. And these days, you know, I more manage the teams, but I've always... I've learned from experience that, you know, I've gone away in the past on films where I've been a solo player, as I call it. You know, it's sort of, they call you up and they say, hey, come and, you know, like Casino Royale was a good example. I went over to do the opening sequence of that film and I went by myself and you walk into a team of really cool guys, but at the time they're all strangers. You don't know them. So that's always a little bit tricky when you're the sort of the odd one out. So, you know, over the years, I've really just developed a taste for going, well, if I go somewhere, I'd really love to have the guys that I work with.
Yeah.
And you know then that the workflow is going to be a lot easier. You know that the language you're all speaking is familiar so that when you are working on set, it's you're all one. You're not sort of having to relearn a language of how another team works or how people communicate with each other. And in the film industry...
So it's less like back and forth.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the working on set in a high-stress situation, the less communication that you have to have, the better, because you just want to be getting work done and you don't want to be debating or explaining or rehashing or saying something again. It's kind of like an unwritten language that you can communicate with very little, which is always a better way to go.
So it sounds like it might be an added layer of challenge if you need to coordinate with a local stunt crew or something like that.
When you are working on overseas productions, and I've just come back from working on Uncharted in Berlin, and as soon as you take a shore to a film to another shore, you're going to deal with obviously different teams, different ways of doing things, different ways of communication and different languages. So you have to become very savvy with that sort of stuff. And what makes it easier is to be surrounded by people that you're familiar with. Otherwise you will be spending a lot of time working out what they're just saying in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure. It must be, like you're saying, difficult to have to rehash just the communication aspect of it. And let me say, very excited about what Uncharted is going to be like on the big screen. Definitely a big fan of the games. I'm looking forward to that one.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty epic.
Good. I like that word. I like that word.
Yeah, it's really cool.
And I think we're going to kick it over to Darren too. I think he's curious about your process a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I'm kind of wondering how stunts, I guess, like evolve from just being in your head to then going on and like performing it for real. Like, how does it go from that, just that idea to actually coming to fruition into real life?
Yeah, that's a great question. My process has always been, I'm a super visual person. So for me, if I'm reading a script or looking at a storyboard or watching a previs, I've always been lucky where I can I can sort of picture something in my mind how I can see it would happen. If it's a rigging evolution particularly, or a piece of action that involves rigging, I've always had this ability to sort of be able to look up at the sky in a sense and go, well, okay, the guy starts here and he ends here. So therefore the tool or the rigging structure that we would need in place would kind of look like this. So I picture cranes in my mind. I can picture where lines run. And so from that, I usually do really bad drawings that take more interpretation with other people to work them out. But I've always been a believer that you capture your ideas before they escape, because if you don't, they're gone. So,
Way you can. Yeah.
Absolutely. I've ripped pages out of phone books and scribbled on them in the past to capture ideas. Yeah. And I've just learned that these things are fleeting, and the more that I used to stress about where ideas would come from and how we would achieve certain bits of action, whether it was a fight or a car chase or a rigging stunt. But then, after many years of doing it now, I just kind of let it go. And I know that the ideas will come. And as soon as they come, you write them down. Even if they're not relevant, they could be relevant for something else or inspire you to think of, what you're trying to achieve.
Right, right. You need a way to like quickly capture those ideas,
Absolutely. I mean, if you could see my hotel room at the moment.
Oh my goodness.
I'm a great believer in the sticky pad.
Yeah, definitely.
Ideas, sticky pads. Sticky pads everywhere with all sorts of shit written on them. But it's, for me, that's one of my go-to ways of capturing something. I'll wake up in the middle of the night and get up and jot ideas down and go back to bed knowing that I caught the thing.
Yeah, I know somewhere you mentioned that you also use like Shot Pro and I guess like your iOS device to just plan things out in that way too.
Yeah, definitely. When you're going to niche down onto, like if you've thought of a piece of choreography, particularly for car chases or car sequences, you can kind of think of the choreography. Then usually what we do is we'll get the little matchbox cars out and we'll set them out on a table. And then,
oh yeah, yeah. I know Tom Struthers was saying something about that too.
Yeah, yeah. So we take pictures of them. So we'll move the cars around and go, well, this would be a profile. This would be this way. This would be a tracking shot. And then we'd kind of map it out and photograph each little sequence like a storyboard. And then we'd put that into Shot Pro and then Shot Pro the sequence. So then you can niche in on, okay, how would we cover this piece of action? Are we left to right? Are we right to left? Are we down the line? How do we cover this? So Shot Pro is a great tool to put your sequence together and see if you've got your coverage, before you go off and shoot something and then you get to the edit and you go, oh, we should have got this and we should have got that.
I'm assuming it's also a great tool to like communicate to like the director that you're working with too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because a lot of the time those sort of sequences are very hard to explain visually because, you can't stand there going, then the car's sideways. And then this guy comes along here and then he comes through an intersection. The director will be like, oh, I'll stop. I work in shot in with this setup. So if you can show them Shot Pro, then you don't need to speak and they can see it for themselves and they can like it or not, or go, okay, I love that, but let's change this and do that. And then that way, then the creative flow can start happening.
Definitely. Because I think it's kind of difficult. I mean, still, when you're writing it down on paper, I think that's kind of how I remember George Miller was saying that everything was just pictures, kind of like an animatic format.
Yeah, on Fury Road, it was thousands of them, thousands of storyboards. And that was our the visual representation of the whole film was in storyboard form, and that was genius because you could virtually watch the movie by turning the page and understand the vision,
kind of like a comic book. Yeah.
Oh, it's brilliant. Yeah, it really is a brilliant way of doing it.
Yeah, that's awesome. I kind of wanted to also transition into talking about writing and directing, because I know you also are into writing and directing. Similar to when we also interviewed like Sam Hargrave and his direction, his transition into like directing with Extraction. I know you have a short film, Driven. I'm kind of wondering what it was like transitioning from like stunt coordination to like the directing and writing side. And like, what did you learn from like the stunt world that kind of carried over to like that project?
You know, it's a great question. For me, the transition's been, the filmmaking side of it is very familiar. So to be able to step from coordinating where you are in a sense directing a sequence for the director, as in terms of like orchestrating a stunt. So the directing side of it, you know, I feel is a natural transition, especially for a stunt coordinator who's always at the pointy end of the film set with the actors and the action.
Right.
So, you know, you get to understand all of the departments and how they work, you know, what the DOP is doing, what the gaffer is doing, what the grips are doing. So technically you're always on point with the film crew. So technically speaking, you know, coordinators or stunt coordinators can transition quite easily into direction, you know, which has been great for me because, I've been on the pointy end of the stick for so many years. So you do get to see how directors work, how they interact with the actors.
Yeah.
You get to work with a plethora of different directors. So you see, you know, how they do business, which is paid education, really.
Right, and, right. Yeah. Yeah. Being on set is like the best form of education.
Oh, it's brilliant. It's really in the film industry to learn it. It's kind of really the best way to go. If you get a formal education in film, then the next step would be get on a film set because it's complete chaos.
Mm. Oh yeah.
And it's chaos and madness and it's hectic and confusing as shit. And that's where you kick up a gear and go, okay, this is rapid accelerated learning here, by crikey. And then the writing side of it, I woke up a few years ago and I thought, right, the best way for me to really understand film and story and structure and plot and character and story arcs and, you know, the hero's journey, et cetera, was to start writing. So that's what I've done. And I've really fallen into a niche of, becoming addicted to writing, and that to me now is the direction that I've settled on, because I just think being able to sit down and write a screenplay and create characters and a story is such a powerful tool, not only to create the document, which is the screenplay, but also to really truly understand story and filmmaking. Because you sit there and you write and you go, well, does this scene make sense? Is it, am I writing something that's moving the story forwards, or am I just writing something because I think it's a cool idea and, you know, think, oh, the audience is going to love this, but really, does it make any sense for the story? Does it do something to the characters? Right. Is it interesting? You know, so writing for me now is a huge part of the process for, you know, my journey as a filmmaker, because I think that's the starting point for the understanding of how it all works.
Yeah, it makes you think very big picture, I feel like.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm also someone who is addicted to writing a little bit, and the understanding of story that gives you. I actually saw on Instagram some sort of screenplay that said Sam Riley, written by Keir Beck. Do you have any updates on what that is or where that's going?
Yes, that's a script that I've been doing for a couple of years now. They're sort of refining and rewriting. And funnily enough, I've got a phone call with a producer after this call about Sam Riley. So it's a kind of a highly fueled action film about a couple of brothers, that one of the brothers dies in a diamond heist. So it's Extraction plus.
Yeah, like that. We'll be extraction.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Big time. It was such a. It was great. I think it was just a breath of fresh air watching such a different action movie for a change. No superheroes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and good luck in your meeting coming up. Definitely.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Yeah, it's It's good. Yeah, it's going to be interesting.
And I know I heard one time some story about you having to really fight for a certain Mad Max stunt where you had a war boy jumping onto a car with two sticks, two thunder sticks.
Yes.
I'm wondering how often do things get sort of contentious like that, where you have to fight someone to get something done or maybe pull back on something?
That particular stunt, the battle was with the engineer, the film set engineer, who was sort of like the guy who walked around rating and certifying the way certain things were done, whether it was on a vehicle or a stunt like that one we were particularly trying to do. So, yeah, I run on intuition and I take my brain with me to defend my ideas. So that was a particularly, you know, that gag for me was I knew in my stomach that we could do it practically. So we could rig it and take the vehicle out onto the road and do the stunt practically. And that was just an intuitive idea, and I could see the rig in my mind and we set it up, but I had, you know, just, you know, people doubting, you know, the size of the structure was huge on the truck and it was very, it looked intimidating. And so, you know, when people get fearful or a bit nervous, they'll get defensive and not necessarily back you because they're unsure of the outcome themselves. So, you know, in that case, I won, which is, I was never going to give up anyway. So wouldn't have mattered.
Came out well.
Amazing stunt.
Yeah.
Would you say that intuition you were talking about is something you naturally have, or is it something you had to develop over time?
That people have asked me that before. I think my intuition, I mean, I guess things are always there and they just, you either grow them or you don't. But I think being an arborist for so many years taught me to run on a gut feeling on how something would go, because in the tree world, you only get one chance at, you know, taking the head out of a tree or dropping a tree or cutting a branch off. You don't get to reset it if it goes wrong and, you know, kills someone's mailbox or, you know, rips a line of guttering off or hits a power line. Or there's so many things that can go wrong in a tree situation, working with chainsaws and ropes and wind and weather and unpredictable trees, that you have to have some form of you know, the intuition, gut feeling to make sure you're going to get it right, because like I say, you can't put it back and have another go.
Mm. And were there any particularly difficult rigs or stunts that you've ever had to sort of utilize that intuition for?
Oh yeah, lots and lots. A Casino Royale was one of those, because that was a fairly intensive sequence to be able to, you know, do the characters jumping from crane to crane on the day. And the thing that made that tricky was that stunt was done on a call, so a 5-4-3-2-1 countdown. And on the day, the wash of the helicopter which we had to shoot it, we didn't account for the fact that the down wash would affect the cranes. So the cranes were moving, and we couldn't tether the cranes off because of they have a windbreak on them, so we couldn't hold the cranes in position. So the cranes were moving back, like slightly in and out. So for the performers to jump, they had to compensate for the movement to get the stunt right. So I just remember on the day just going, you know, we had to be so on our game, because then again, that's a one take evolution. Even though we did it a couple of times, if something goes wrong, it goes wrong really badly. So, you know, so that was one of those occasions. And another one for me, probably one of the biggest ones, was Mad Max sliding a guy on a motorbike through the moving wheels of a semi-trailer truck. And, you know, that stunt had to be absolutely 100% perfect with no out. There was no out. You know, we couldn't abort mission or stop halfway through. Once the stunt started, it had to go through to fruition, to finish, and perfectly, because otherwise, you know, we're dealing with a semi-trailer with really big tires on them and lots of them. So, you know, that to me was one of those days where I felt almost a little bit ill. I was really happy when it was done.
Mm. Yeah. I'm sure it's definitely a lot of pressure having to have all those people's safety in your hands and trying to please everyone as well, from the directors and the actors and, of course, the stunt people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You get it from all angles when you're dealing with that sort of the pointy end of the stick when you're doing stunts like that. You are responsible for somebody else's life, you know, and you've got to remember that first and foremost, that, you know, it's not a game when you're doing things like that. You want the outcome to be fantastic for the director, obviously, but more so you want the outcome that everyone's safe at the end of the day.
Yeah. And I think that kind of moves on to my next question. When building a rig, where do you start? Like, what are the basics that you always kind of come back to?
I guess my, you know, I have a sort of a formula of, you know, I start from the end, you know, where is, like, if it's a guy moving from A to B or flying from A to B, I'll always go, okay, well, if I know where A is, but where's B? And then I can go, okay, to get somebody to this point here, I kind of deconstruct and work backwards. So, you know, that's, you know, sort of a process that I have as far as going, okay, we need to move someone from here to there. How would it look? Is it a crane? Is it a truss grid? Is it something that moves above them? So there's so many variables. So, you know, I kind of look at all of them at the same time and then eliminate. And you always know that there's 50 ways of doing the same thing. So you just kind of niche down to something that you're familiar with and you know that's going to be reliable as it can work repeatedly the same way every time, which is one of the most important things.
Yeah, so it's kind of like reverse engineering a little bit.
Absolutely. I walk around for the, you know, once the rig is set up, it becomes a tool and then you use the tool to get the outcome. But at the same time, I'm always, you know, I have a little saying to myself, which is, where's the viper? What can I, you know, what's in there that I can, you know, that I haven't seen, and what can I do better? So that's kind of like my way of continuous improvement, to look at my work. And even if it's working, I'll look at it with a critical eye to just go, what have I missed and how can I do this better? And that sort of then translates to the next time you do something, you won't miss anything and you will do it better.
Yeah. And I'm also wondering, so we were looking around online a little bit and we found some terms: rigging for picture, combined rigging, and rigging for illusion. Can you enlighten us a little bit on what the differences between those are?
Okay, sure. Well, I'll start with rigging for illusion. So illusion is giving the sense that it's actually Superman flying without the assistance of wires. So rigging for illusion is you know, using small tech lines and harnesses that are hidden underneath wardrobes. So then when VFX take over, they paint out the wires and they skim the wardrobe to get rid of the bulkiness of the harness, and then that way, the, you know, it looks like Superman's actually leaping up into space and flying around by himself. So that's the illusion of that side of rigging. And rigging for picture is best example is, you know, a Pirates of the Caribbean, where, you know, someone's swinging on a rope through a sailing boat. So your rigging is on picture, so it might be a prop rope that you've incorporated a safety line inside a prop hemp rope to attach to the actor so they can do a rope swing. So the rigging is seen on camera. And what was the other one?
Combined rigging.
Oh, combined. Yeah, okay. So combined rigging is often when you'll combine a system which has rigging to the performer, which will be, you know, which VFX will paint out, and then you'll combine it with a set rigging as well. The same sort of example, like it might be a rope swing or someone climbing up a rope, or, you know, in that sense where you're seeing the picture rigging and you're not seeing the rigging that they're attached to. So those examples, technically what they're for is to establish early days who's responsible for what.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as far as, you know, who rigs the prop rope, who rigs the stunt rigging stuff. So it's,
so there's different teams for each.
Yeah, like that. Like usually, what would happen if there was say Charlie opens the door and sees a rope and grabs it and starts climbing. You know, that could be the scene description. You go, well, okay, well, Charlie opens the door and sees a rope. Who put the rope there? Is that the art department or props
The
stunt department put it there? Who's responsible for that rope and what is it? So that's just a production breakdown way of establishing responsibility, I guess. Who's got ownership of something?
Interesting. And I was wondering also too, because I saw in Mad Max, of course, you have the insane, I think he's called the Doof Warrior, the dude with the double electric flamethrowing guitar on the big speaker car. The one character who's actually strapped into the vehicle as part of the world.
Yes.
So I'm also wondering, like, was there any thought or any work on your part in terms of how those, you know, ropes and pulleys would look on picture, things like that?
So that's a great one to bring up, actually, because the art department originally, that's their ownership, is to create that whole vehicle and the look of it and the guitar and the way the character was attached. Mm-hmm. And then where I came into play was that the bungees that he was on. So I actually made the bungee, and then I had laced a tech line through that bungee system so that it acted as a redundancy in case something did break, but it also still gave him the ability to bounce around. So, and we supplied the pulleys, and the art department dressed them up to look like part of the vehicle. So, you know, that's a combination of us providing life support rigging that we knew was structural and integrous to be able to withstand the guy bouncing around on it, and durable enough to last as long as it did for the show. And then the art department took over and dabbled paint on it and, you know, made it look all gacky and old like the rest of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think one of the funniest and coolest parts of it too is that his guitar is also roped in, but not attached to him. It's separately bungeed onto the vehicle. So he goes one way.
Yeah. I've actually still got that little bungee that was attached to that guitar. I don't know what I'm going to do with it.
When you start your rock.
Yeah, but that again was us. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We were also, so again, you know, we've been looking online, looking at all your works and things like that. We, of course, found that you teach some instructional courses, and I was wondering where the idea for that sort of came from.
So I do. I have been teaching, and I never thought I would, actually, to be honest with you. But it got to the point where I just was sitting down one day, and I was like, you know, I have so many ideas, and I've kept a record of pretty much every rig that I've designed since 1998 in notebooks. There's thousands of strange drawings and scribbles and notes on rigs and descriptions of how I've done things. And I just, you know, one day I was thinking, oh, it's kind of a pity to keep it locked up and not share it with people. So, you know, I just thought I've been so fortunate in my career to be able to have done what I've done and to be creative and to travel and I just think it's a really nice thing to share what you've learned and give a few tips. If it helps someone out along the way to make their career work for them as well, that's a good thing. And, you know, so, you know, I've got a website and you know, I just travel around the world every now and again. When I get time, I'll go and run a rigging course, and it's really nice to be able to share. And the wonderful thing is actually on Uncharted, I think, had a rigging crew of 32 guys, and I think 24 of them had done my course around the world at some stage. So that was the payoff for me, was to be able to be in Germany and call a guy from Poland and Slovakia and, wow, you know, I think we had 11 different, 9 different countries in our rigging crew, because they're all guys that had you know, stood out on the rigging courses. I'm like, I'll made a call from Ireland and this guy from here and someone from Estonia, and which is fun at the end of the day to be able to bring these people all together. And, right. and you know, obviously they all understand the language because they've done the course.
I think there was definitely a need for it, a demand for it, at least.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, the big win for me is the fact that I've just experienced so many different scenarios as far as outcomes and go. And I just see that education and safety go hand in hand, and also longevity in the film industry. And just, you know, if I can make a few little improvements to keep people safe and give, you know, they can walk away with a little bit more knowledge on particularly on the safety side of it, then I think that's a good thing to do for the industry.
Definitely. And I'm wondering, kind of like after teaching all these classes and writing your book, what are like some common mistakes that you've seen like in beginner stunt riggers?
Probably getting out of their depth too easily, because sometimes it's easy to be pressured into doing things that you're not quite ready to take on. So, you know, administratively, someone who's got a limited experience, particularly in the rigging world, can be asked to do something that they might not be comfortable to do, but they'll say yes because they're afraid of the consequence of saying, "Hey, no, I'm not the guy for the job," or "Hey, that's probably a bit too much," or let me you know, do some research, or let me get someone who can help and contribute to get the outcome you're after. So those sort of things can catch people out, and little mistakes, you know, not setting end marks in rigs, and just being not having the experience to be aware of something that could become a risk.
Yeah, I think it's like you said, taking on stunts that are, I guess, bigger than you. I believe you mentioned before.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and it's always, I mean, when you have the experience, it's fine to take on challenges that you know are possibly out of your depth. But if you can manage the risk, if you can manage, you know, the hazardous sides of it and rig your way around those things, you can do anything. But it's just it's putting that as a priority, which is the most important thing. How do I manage the risk of this evolution to get a safe outcome? And then it doesn't matter if you are jumping someone off a huge skyscraper or whatever. If you can manage the risk, then you'll be able to do it.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that, I guess, people should do it right now, but what are, I guess, some simple rig systems that someone can practice with and, I guess, build at home? Like if they're like an intro, I don't know, if they're like new to rigging.
I guess probably the easiest thing, I mean, other than the standard skills of being able to tie knots and create pulley systems and all of that stuff and splicing too, which is a huge part of the biz. So I would start with, you know, it's easy to, you know, providing the tree is structural enough to chuck a sling and a pulley and a single rope in a tree and you know, do a pendulum rigs, which are, you know, if you watch any old Hong Kong martial arts film, you'll see people flying, you know, flying around and jumping and leaping, and that's all done on it's the sort of the one pulley, one rope theory that you just attach someone, and it could be even in a rock climbing.
Wire thing.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And just bounce around on something very simple. Then you can upgrade to a slackline rig, which is, a super effective and easy way to move people around in a bigger space. And it's only slacklines, one rope, one pulley and a pull line and someone on the end of it.
Wow.
That's how I started my trees at home.
With the trees. Yeah.
Yeah.
Aaron and I will definitely.
It's good to know.
We'll jump out. Yeah. We'll start messing with some trees.
There you go. Don't rig off dead branches. That's all I've got to say.
Okay. Yeah, that wouldn't be great.
So I'd love to transition here and talk about some of your specific works. One that I'd love to talk about is Danger Close. It's this Australian Vietnam War film that you were a part of, and you were actually action director for it. So could you tell me a little bit about what that role entails and how it was different from other roles you've had in the past?
So I guess what that was to be an action director. So it's working directly beside the director, Creve, who did a fantastic job on Danger Close. So an action director is someone that will not only as a stunt coordinator, I'd choreograph the action, but then as a director, you're having an involvement with how to cover the sequence. So we would shoot blocks of action as a previs, and then you take the previs, and obviously the director signs off on it. Then on the day, you'll be involved with going, right, well, the best place to cover this little sequence or piece of action is to put a camera here, here, and here. And then so you're just a one more step involved in the sort of, as a stunt coordinator, you would facilitate and bring the action to set, and then the director and the DOP would then determine how to cover the sequence. But as an action director, you're bringing the sequence to set and then orchestrating how the sequence gets filmed as well.
Okay. And so did you ever feel an urge to sort of jump into the more nitty-gritty of the creative process for the roles that maybe you used to have? Or were you very comfortable letting some other people take the reins there?
I mean, it's kind of a progressive thing. Like sometimes you do let, you know, you present action on set and you hand it over to, you know, the adults, so to speak, as far as how the director or the DOP want to cover the sequence. But, you know, that's an important sort of part of the evolution of moving on as well. I think if you get in there and you see how directors and DOPs cover sequences and you learn, okay, well, that camera angle works, that camera angle doesn't work. And then as you progress, you can be, you know, you can present your action and say, well, to get the most effective cover, you'd cover it from here and here and here. And then that way, then you start to progress into being able to, you know, direct the action or to become a second unit director or, you know, eventually direct stuff like Sam has.
Mm.
And Chad Stilowski.
And so, especially as action director specifically, did you feel any added responsibility or even challenge since this was portraying a historic battle to portray things with historical accuracy?
I mean, yes. And it's kind of a good question. Yes, you want it to be, I guess, the film itself and the story has to be historically correct. But the action is always... You know, we tried to make all of the deaths in the film really, you know, super realistic, as you know, as a body that doesn't get shot and blasted back like in a Sylvester Stallone mm-hmm. movie. But you know, you want that side of it to be realistic and a little bit shocking, you know, because it's so unflattering to just be mm-hmm. shot and fall down dead. So we, you know, in that terms, we kept that realistic, and obviously there's some non-realism, you know, we had a few guys getting blown up and blasted through the air with explosions, which, you know, just complements the action and it makes it more exciting for the audience to watch.
Yeah, and I think talking about historical war films too, I want to kind of touch on Hacksaw Ridge as well. Because I know in Hacksaw Ridge, there's this famous scene where Desmond Doss actually builds a rope system to send the soldiers down. I'm kind of wondering, were you heavily involved in the process of like designing that rope system? And if so, what was it like for you?
Yeah, I built the rope system for that sequence. Yeah. Yeah, so that was, and that's a great example of rigging for picture. So we had a line, a tech line that we had dressed by the art department. So they sort of degraded the line to make it look like an old cable or rope, and you know, we rigged it up and we had tripods and concrete blocks, and you know, wherever there was a hemp line, we had tech line running through it. So basically we built that whole system from scratch. You know, we did the same with the little trolley that was on there for the soldiers to get lowered on. We built that as well, and we had tech lines running through that. So yeah, we dressed down the pulleys that were rated, and so that was a whole process that we undertook to achieve that.
Yeah, and I kind of like it because I know earlier in the film there was like this ongoing joke that Desmond kind of ties the knot wrong, kind of like a bra, but it kind of like ends up working out well for him.
Yeah, 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 I showed him how to tie the bowline. The funny thing was, on the day, I had to tie it around him. But when you tie something backwards, when you tie something facing away from you, I almost didn't get it right, to tell you the truth. I stood there, a little bit of a panic moment, going, oh, I don't actually think I've tied a bowline this way for a long time. But I still managed to do it, which was lucky. Saved a bit of embarrassment.
Yeah, I knew you, there was some probably inspiration from you in that scene.
Mm. It is fun to be able to, you know, watch the movie and see, oh, I go, oh, I tied that knot and oh, I instigated that the way that got done. So that's always, that's the payoff, I guess, of being able to watch something that you worked on that turned out really, really well.
Oh, yeah. And I know we're kind of running a little bit short on time. I don't know how much time you have exactly. I just want to...
I'm in quarantine, bro. I've got all day.
Okay, great. But I wanted to move on to Mad Max, actually, because I wanted to know, what was your relationship like with George Miller and the team at Mad Max?
Oh, fantastic. I mean, when you work on a film, especially an Australian production like that, it's just a great big family. Like George Miller is, you know, he's just the most wonderful person you could ever meet. And you're inspired to do a really good job because he's just such an incredible person to be around as a person and as a director and as someone that cares for his film crew. So, you know, when you're surrounded by people like that, you're inspired to always be doing better and well and making sure the project has a great outcome.
Yeah. And I know you mentioned also that George kind of put very little restrictions on what you could do. Do you think you could talk about how much, I guess, creative freedom you had with the creative process for like designing these stunts?
Sure. Well, I guess, I mean, once you're always going to stick to a particular glide path from the storyboards, as far as, you know, what the images they are wanting to capture. But as far as creatively coming up with the way to achieve that and to, you know, to exacerbate and make it a little bit more, little bit bigger and a little bit more sort of, you know, hectic or grand, there was, you know, I don't think I got told once on the whole show to pull back or stop hiring cranes or stop buying miles and miles of rope. So for me, it was a private free for all creatively because I could just go for it. And, I don't know if I'll ever work on a show that like that again with that sort of ability to have a huge crack at it.
So George was just kind of like, just keep going. Don't stop.
Yeah. He was just like, he was just like, whatever you turn up with, we'll shoot. So I'm like, Roger that. I'll I can do that. Yeah.
Damn. So like any idea kind of just got into the film somehow.
Yeah. I mean, everything all of the stunts that we rigged, I don't think any of them didn't make it into the film, which is amazing. You know, usually you rig stuff and you do things and certain things don't make it, but you know, everything that we did was in there, which was fantastic.
Yeah, it all looks great. This is the single movie that I had to sneak into to see because I saw the trailer for it, all the stunts, all the action, and me and my friend just, you know, we had to see it in the theater on the big screen. And it was worth sneaking into.
Oh, yeah. Excellent.
Oh, I believe, yeah. You were telling me that you were under age at the time.
Yeah, still in high school. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Oh, well done.
Thank you. It was worth it.
Yeah, I mean, I still look at it now and just wonder how the hell we did it. I really do.
Yeah, and I know actually during shooting, the lead actors were talking a little bit about how they weren't sure if it was going to come together. Like they couldn't see it in their heads, what George Miller was envisioning. Did you personally, were you able to sort of see it coming together or did you have any doubts about how you guys were capturing it on film?
I didn't have any doubts at all or any sort of, like you would watch playback and see rushes from the dailies and just witnessing, you know, being on set, watching them, you know, photograph the sequences. So for me, I kind of always just, and understanding the other Mad Max films I could see, you know, I didn't know exactly what the story, you know, how it was going to cut together in completion, obviously, but I could see the story coming together and I could understand the journey of Mad Max and Furiosa and what was going on. So, you know, I never doubted that this is, you know, when you're working on something that epic and that intense, you just know that it's going to be good.
Yeah, definitely. And it definitely was good. And then I have to go back to that flame-throwing guitar player again one more time. So I'm wondering, I know it was a popular Australian musician, Iota, who was up in the rig over there with the guitar. Was he actually playing?
Yep.
And did you have to overcome any challenges to rig him so that he would be able to actually play up there?
Yeah, well, he had a couple of doubles that would, and funnily, both of them could play the guitar, so not as well as he could, obviously, but Iota did do a fair amount of work up on the Doof vehicle with the guitar playing. So, you know, periodically he would be up there for, you know, hours doing, you know, take after take or shot after shot. And, yeah, the whole thing worked as a real musical kit. Obviously on the, you know, in the edits, they, you know, went over the music again, but on the day he could play the guitar and it was pretty epic.
In real time.
Yeah. Right. It was very cool.
So, I mean, a lot of these stunts are like on top of like moving vehicles. And I saw some behind the scenes where you guys just shot without moving the vehicles and just shot from the ground up. I'm kind of wondering what the difference is between rigging on a moving vehicle versus just the flat ground. Like,
yeah, sure. Well, sometimes so if we're doing a static shot, but trying to create the illusion of it moving, we're doing a sim trav shot. So the vehicle might be on a sim trav base, which gives the, you know, the articulation of a moving vehicle. Mm. And then it's basically wind and dust. And sometimes we would shoot that way because it might have been something very specific to capture, like a close-up or a certain piece of action that required that's you're better off shooting it statically to save time and to be more efficient rather than taking something out on the road and trying to do something that, you know, if you just put wind and dust in the background, it would work
Because the audience can't tell the difference if it's just the sky, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, financially and you know, and just in terms of actual filmmaking, it's better sometimes to be able to just sim trav something and get an insert or get an acting beat. That's often the best way to go, unless, you know, you're shooting plate shots and you can, you know, or you go out on the road and do it for real, or you shoot plate shots and do it as a sim trav element.
And when you were when you were going in to grab those shots, is there a sense of like, were you relieved, like, oh, thank God we can sort of slow down the pace and we don't have to be gunning it down the desert in a car to get these shots? Or were you disappointed a little bit?
That's a good question, because sometimes there's so much going on. Like, you might be doing a sim trav shot picking up a small element from a sequence you've done the day before or leading up to something else. But on when you're in that environment, you're going, okay, I've got to do this. I'm going to do the sim trav thing, and then I've got to whiz over to the other location, check out the lads who are rigging this, and then I've got to think about what's going on tomorrow, and then, I've got to build the truss grid for that thing next week. So that your brain is just constantly going, okay, I've got to make sure I've got three guys here and two guys here. I need three operators on that rig. Okay, shit, let's get this done. And so that you kind of, your brain is working at a million mile an hour. And if you are doing a sim trav thing, the best thing is that you can go and grab a cup of tea and a muffin. And you know, you don't have to be on the road in the dust and out there in the heat and bumping around on the road trying to do something. So it does give you some reprieve to take a moment. But at the same time, you're still planning. There's other rigs, other evolutions, prep happening. So it's just part of your day. It just turns into, you know, that part of your day.
Yeah. And I think when we're talking about the vehicles moving, how fast were those vehicles actually going? You do like that illusion of a high speed, I guess, on camera.
Yeah, so sometimes, I mean, the vehicles didn't particularly go hugely fast, mm-hmm. and they didn't really need to. I mean, that again comes down to filmmaking and how you know frame rates and how you shoot sequences and stuff. So not necessarily anywhere between, you know, maybe up to 60 kilometers an hour at times, which in terms of film is you know, when you're looking at through a little square box, it looks quite quick.
Yeah.
And you know, so it doesn't need to be huge. I mean, films like Fast and Furious, which I did last year, and they are going quick. You know, they're doing.
Oh, they're going fast.
Oh yeah, yes. Like the title, you know, they don't muck around. Surprisingly, actually, because I hadn't done a fast film until last year. So, you know, when you're actually involved with it, you go, wow, that actually they do drive fast. Whereas Mad Max didn't have to be. You know, it didn't have to be. There's so much going on in sequences that you
there's a lot going on top of the cars.
Absolutely, everywhere.
Yeah, and I think that was kind of where the attention was focused. But I'm kind of wondering, like, was it the same patch of land that you guys were going, like, back and forth on? Or were you guys just going?
Sometimes, yes. There was one location called Blanky Flats, which is part of the Namib Desert. And it's literally, I haven't been to the moon, but I imagine it's pretty bloody close to what it would be like on the surface. There's just nothing there, hey? So we would go back and forth on that same patch of ground. But there was multiple locations in Namibia that we shot at, you know, sort of stretching, you know, be a couple of hundred kilometers apart between locations sometimes.
Yeah, because I know you also had that like night scene as well, and it was just a completely different landscape.
Yeah, that place was so brutal. It was it was just, everyone hated that. It was so cold. It was right on the ocean, so it would just get this brutal, bitter cold wind whipping off the ocean at night. There's no place you can hide from it.
Well, it was kind of like a little bit different, like texture of the ground too and everything.
Yeah, it was in a very salty area of coastal plain, and they had this like a bacteria in the ground that made the ground sort of pinkish color, like a pinkish color. Yeah, it was pretty interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd actually love to keep talking about sand for a second. So I know there's a whole lot of physics calculations that go into your stunts, and I know sand can really change the friction and the profile of a surface. So is that a factor when you were planning out, especially the cars for the stunts?
Yeah, the soil is always a big consideration for how the vehicles are going to behave. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be as much as the damn things will get bogged, or they'll, you know, they don't steer as well. You know, you'll bog into the sand and you'll plane or drift in the direction that you don't particularly want to go in because of the soil density. So, you know, always, you know, that's, you can always see the drivers of the vehicles kicking the ground and having a good look at the surface capability to be able to gauge what their vehicles are going to be able to do in it. So it's a huge consideration, big difference to working on solid surfaces or bitumen.
I'm kind of wondering how much do physics and calculations come into play when planning out these stunts?
Yeah, it's a fair bit. With vehicles, it's more about precision and timing and the speed of entry and the speed of exit or the speed of hitting something. So sort of the physics side of that is more or less how well a vehicle responds, what is it capable of doing. Whereas with other physical stunts that involve rigging, yes, physics, there's a lot of physics involved, and especially when you combine movement of people on a moving vehicle, then physics changes its world completely, because then you're dealing with anomalies of, you know, inertia created by the vehicle, inertia created by the performer combined with the inertia of a vehicle. So there's, you know, physics. Not that I did any sort of physics at school, but you kind of get a pretty quick education on how it all works when you're combining those elements together. That's for sure.
Gotcha. It's a useful skill, I guess, for stunt coordinators in general.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I'm actually a physics major right now. I want to go into film, so that's the perfect answer when people ask me, oh, what are you going to do with your degree? I thought I'd have to say, like, nothing with a physics degree.
There you go. Well, you know how to, you know what inertia means and movement and acceleration and deceleration. They're the sort of things that you have to equate for when you're dealing with people and rigging and machines, winches and ratchets and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Were there any small victories, I guess, or stunts that might have been overlooked by the audience, but I guess the crew found satisfying?
In Fury Road, I guess.
Yeah, in Fury Road.
I don't know, actually. I think looking back at it, I get lots of comments about the, you know, the sliding the guy under the truck, the jump off the back of the war rig, and some of the motorbike jumps, and the guys getting pulled off the bikes in the air. So there's, I guess it's kind of like a bit of a combo pack, really. You know, people love certain things and more than others, I guess. So it's, you know, it's well-rounded, I suppose, the answer.
Definitely. Mike, I know you have a couple other ones that you
want to cover. I do, yeah. I think this might be one of our last Bad Max questions, but couldn't help but notice that there's a scene where the war rig is winched up to a tree to get itself moving again. So did you happen to have anything to do with that particular stunt with the tree?
I was there the night they did the winching out with the dead tree. And a little bit unrealistic, I guess, that the dead tree would pull a big vehicle like that out of the bog. But it was a special effects gag, more or less.
Gotcha.
Okay. We're thinking that it kind of related to your tree experience a little bit.
I did check the tree out. It's just, well, it was well dead.
Dead, yeah, okay.
Really brought the career full circle, I think.
Uh-huh, yeah, absolutely.
I'd actually also love to ask you a little bit about the Uncharted film that you mentioned already, because, again, I'm a big fan of that franchise. One of my favorite game studios of all time is responsible for that game. Did you happen to have any relationship with the franchise before joining onto the film?
No, I didn't. To be honest with you, I didn't even know Uncharted was a game until someone told me. So I'm sorry. But yes, no, I didn't. I didn't. It'll be epic.
Again, great work.
We've made
great
it work. Epic.
Epic for sure.
And
thanks, buddy.
You know, I know a lot of video game adaptations, especially for films, get a bad rap. Do you think, is this the one to really change that trend?
I hope so. It'd be good to have worked on the one that worked.
I got high hopes for it. High hopes. Looks like a good team.
Yeah, definitely. I think Tom Holland and Mark Wahlberg make it.
Wait, what? Mark Wahlberg?
Yeah, what? Tom Holland and Mark Wahlberg are in it.
Interesting. Okay. I knew one. I didn't know the other.
Yeah. Yeah, they did a great job.
Well, I think this is going to be our last question. But before that, I just want to thank you for coming on the podcast. It's been great having you and just loved hearing what you had to say about Mad Max.
Cool. Thanks, man. Yeah, thanks, guys. It's great to chat.
Definitely. Our final question is kind of going to be like a fun one. But if you could build your own Mad Max rig, what would be the Kierbeck Mad Max car? What would that look like?
Ooh, that's a good question. It'd have to be the last of the great V8s, as he says. I'd go with the Charger.
The Charger.
Definitely. Yeah. Charger with a big old donk sticking out the front and no bonnet.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, Kier, for coming on the podcast.
Cheers, guys. Yes, thanks, Darren. Thanks, Mike.
Yep, thank you.